right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and strap yourselves in today because we are in for a hell of a show. This is a show that's going to get you both angry and horrified and hopefully break open your head a little bit and get us all to start thinking about why things are the way they are and how they can be different. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's one of the initiators of the End Porn and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women initiative, going up and challenging these people wherever they appear. And Sansara was recently arrested along with Alice Woodward as they were leaving St. Patrick's Cathedral with a group of women and men who were part of Take Patriarchy by Storm, a 10-day push to take patriarchy by storm. So we'll be talking with Sansara about all of that. But opening the show up, we're going to talk about something that I haven't really talked with you about before, and that is what's happening with the whole situation around hunger and the effort to stop hunger. Here you have the most technologically developed societies in the history of humanity, and yet nothing can be done to stop hunger. This is something that has to give all of us pause, all right? Ask yourselves this. Why is it that nothing will be done unless it can be turned into profit, unless it can first be transformed into capital and the potential of reaping a profit can be right out there? That's when they'll start to do something. And so now what is their answer to hunger? They talk about genetically modified food, genetically modified animals, all of this, which is causing great havoc and damage to the plants, to the animals, and to the humans who eat all of this, not to mention to the entire global ecosystem. I recently watched a DVD called Scientists Under Attack, Genetic Engineering in the Magnetic Field of Money. It's a DVD made by a German filmmaker, Bertram Fairhag, and it tells the story of two scientists, Dr. Arpad Pusztai and Dr. Ignacio Chapella, whose research showed negative findings on genetically modified foods and crops. And both of these scientists suffered the fate of all those who challenged the powerful vested interests that dominate agribusiness and scientific research. They were vilified and intimidated, attempts were made to suppress and discredit their research, and their careers were severely damaged. And I'm really pleased to say that we have joining us on the show today, activist, author, and consumer advocate Jeffrey Smith, who was in the film and who is also the founder of the Institute for Responsible Technology. And then a little later in the segment, we'll be joined by Dr. Ignacio Chapella, microbial ecologist and mycologist at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the scientists whose story is told in Scientists Under Attack. In 2001, Ignacio was the target of a campaign financed by Monsanto for a paper he published in the journal Nature on the effects of genetically modified corn on the native species grown in southern Mexico. The campaign actually led to the unprecedented action of the paper being withdrawn by Nature and further attacks on Dr. Chapella. So let's first join Jeffrey. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. A very powerful DVD, a very powerful story, and you've been at the heart of a lot of what's going on around this. Tell my listeners, really, how big a problem is genetically modified crops and food?
Well, we think that it's contributing to an increase in a variety of health disorders and diseases on the rise since GMOs were introduced. The gastrointestinal problem disorders, reproductive disorders, immune system problems are not only increasing dramatically since 1996, these are the same type of disorders that get better in patients that are prescribed non-GMO diets by their doctors, in livestock that switch from GMO to non-GMO, in pets that switch from GMO to non-GMO, and they're the same disorders found in laboratory animals fed genetically modified feed in experiments.
When you're talking about this, is this something that, I mean, look, you know, frankly, we go into the supermarket, you know, most of us, even those of us who, oh, we're going to eat healthy, we go to the farmer's market. Does this have any impact on us? I mean, this is something that I'm trying to figure out here. It's like, you know, there's this, you know, a lot of people will ask you, well, what the, you know, okay, so some things are being done, some crops are being modified, some crops are better able, you know, to resist whatever, you know, bugs or poisons or whatever, or you know, some kind of, you know, even drought. I mean, if you think about it, if you could actually engineer a crop to wheat to grow in the Sahara Desert, you know, wouldn't that help humanity? So what are we talking about in terms of a problem here?
Well, for the corn, for example, they're genetically engineering it to produce its own toxic insecticide, which breaks open the stomach of insects and kills them. This year, a published study found that when they exposed human cells to the same toxin, it did poke holes in the human cells, causing leakage in the same way that it kills insects. They also found last year the BT toxin produced by Monsanto's corn was found circulating in the blood of 93% of pregnant women and 80% of their unborn fetuses. Now, we believe that this may be a strong contributor to the fact that inflammatory bowel disease is up 40% since GMOs were introduced. Ulcerative colitis is up. All sorts of gastrointestinal disorders, leaky gut, which can link to inflammatory reactions, autoimmune disease, allergies, as well as autism and Parkinson's, according to different sources. These are the kind of things that we think are happening inside our gut as a result of eating Monsanto's genetically engineered crops. They also have Roundup Ready soybeans, corn, etc. So we're eating high concentrations of Roundup, and Roundup is linked to endocrine disruption, cancer, Parkinson's, infertility, as well as birth defects. Lab animals fed Roundup Ready crops had changes in damage to their testicles, uterus, ovaries. More than half of the babies died from when the mothers were fed GM soy starting 2 weeks before they conceived, compared to a 10% control. Hamsters fed GM soy by the third generation, most lost the ability to have babies, some had hair growing in the mouth. If you look at what's happening in the current population in the United States, infertility is skyrocketing, and the use of Roundup is skyrocketing. It's found in air samples and water samples. It's all over. So these are some of the serious disorders that we scientists and doctors believe are linked to genetically engineered crops.
And this has a tendency, I think, or at least the chart seems to be moving in the direction of this is ever increasing in terms of its usage. I was just reading something, and I think it was brought out in the film as well, that, you know, a huge amount, is it 86% of soybeans in the U.S. are genetically engineered to withstand Roundup?
Yeah, it's up to 94% right now, 88% of corn, about 93% or 95% of cotton, 95% of sugar beets. These are the main genetically modified crops, and also canola, about 90 or 95%. So if you eat something that doesn't say organic and it doesn't say non-GMO and it contains soy, corn, cottonseed oil, canola oil, sugar from sugar beets, then it's genetically engineered. And these are usually found in processed foods. I'd say 9 out of 10 processed foods that come in packages in the supermarket contain at least one of the derivatives of these genetically modified crops.
Mm. Boy, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our topic today is genetic modification, big corporate genetic modification of food and its impact on crops, on animals, on humanity, and on the entire global ecosystem. And specifically, we're talking about what happens when scientists stand up and reveal all this harm or even question what's going on. And our guests today were both part of a film called Scientists Under Attack, Genetic Engineering in the Magnetic Field of Money. Again, it's sort of for the sake of asking the question, even though I've watched the film and I know the answer, but I think you actually might have something to add to it. You know, it's kind of stunning that there really is no supervision or regulation of all this. Tell people about that.
It's actually an abdication. The White House, under the first Bush administration, instructed the FDA to promote biotechnology. So they created a new position to be basically the food policy czar at the FDA. It was created for Michael Taylor, Monsanto's former attorney, who then said no safety testing is necessary. Companies like Monsanto can tell us that, who told us that PCBs, Agent Orange, and DDT were safe. They can tell us that GMOs are safe without even telling the FDA, without even telling consumers. And then Michael Taylor went to become Monsanto's vice president. Now he's back at the FDA as U.S. food safety czar. A few years after he proclaimed GMOs as no different, documents made public from a lawsuit showed that the FDA's own scientists were of uniform mind with exactly the opposite conclusion that GMOs were unsafe and could create allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. Now, these days, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine reviewed the animal feeding studies that have been done since then and agreed that these things are dangerous. And they said every doctor should prescribe non-GMO diets to every patient because of these immune system problems, reproductive problems, gastrointestinal problems, insulin problems, organ damage, etc. So there's no oversight by the FDA. They don't approve GMOs. The USDA and EPA are basically also captured organizations. And so everyone is leaving it up to Monsanto to determine if its own foods are safe. I talked to a former Monsanto scientist. He said three of his colleagues did safety studies on the milk from cows treated with Monsanto's bovine growth hormone, and these three Monsanto scientists refused to drink milk thereafter. One bought his own cow. They only drink organic milk because they saw a cancer-promoting hormone in such high levels in the milk from treated cows. He said that when Monsanto scientists found significant damage to rats from genetically modified corn, instead of withdrawing the corn from submitting it for approval, they rewrote the study to hide the evidence of danger.
And they sent the rats to live on a deserted island somewhere forever. Yeah, God.
They hid that evidence.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, let's talk about this. We're going to bring on Ignacio Chapela in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about this. Let's talk about no labeling, no supervision, no regulation, no long-term studies. And there are scientists out there who actually aren't happy with this situation. What happens when you have somebody who actually does the work, who's concerned about it, thinks that they're going to be helping humanity, helping, you know, cure problems like, I mean, there is a problem with how do we actually get enough food in the world to feed everyone? And the question of, you know, some scientists might be really moved by or inspired by or motivated by the idea that I want to actually do something about this, you know, and then they blow a whistle. They do studies and they find out, they may not even be thinking they're whistleblowing. They're doing a study and they're thinking, okay, I find out if you do this and you eat this, big problems or big problems in the ecology overall. What happens to whistleblowers?
They're fired, stripped of responsibilities, forced out, threatened, denied tenure, denied funding. Sometimes they're even physically attacked. Let's take the case of Arpad Pusztai, who you talked about, from Scientists Under Attack. He was given $3 million from the UK government to figure out how to test for the safety of GMOs. And to his surprise, he discovered that GMOs were inherently dangerous, causing massive damage to rats in just 10 days. Went public with his concerns, was a hero for 2 days at his prestigious institute, 2 phone calls from the UK Prime Minister's office, 4 through the receptionist to the director. The next day, Pusztai was fired from his job after 35 years, silenced with threats of a lawsuit. He was attacked, vilified in the press, etc. Irina Ermakova discovered dramatic problems. She fed female rats genetically modified soy starting 2 weeks before they got pregnant. More than half of their babies died within 3 weeks. They were also sterile and smaller, compared to a 10% death rate. She was told by a boss who was under pressure from his boss, no more GM research. Papers were burnt on her desk, samples stolen from her laboratory. One of her colleagues tried to comfort her by saying, maybe the GM soy will solve the overpopulation problem. She wasn't comforted. We have Andres Carrasco, who discovered that the injections of Roundup, Monsanto's herbicide, into the embryos of chickens and amphibians caused the same kind of birth defect suffered by peasants who were being sprayed with Roundup. He went to speak at a conference or at a presentation in rural Argentina and was attacked by an organized mob of about 100. They beat his car with him locked inside for 2 hours, and his friends weren't so lucky. One was knocked unconscious, one paralyzed. This is an incredible disincentive, of course, for people to do research. And Ignacio can tell you this. There's very, very few people doing research, and if they want to do research, they usually can't get a hold of the seeds or can't get a hold of the finances, and if they do publish, they do try and publish, it's often blocked from publication. So it's tobacco science by the industry, for the industry, where they have bad science down to a science, and we're left with piecemeal evidence. But if you put it together, it is sufficient to cause thousands of doctors now prescribing non-GMO diets, saying it's clearly unsafe for human consumption.
Wow. All right, Jeff, I want to thank you for joining us today. I know you're in a hurry. If you could stick around for a while, that'd be cool. But if not, I understand that too. Let me remind listeners that we've been talking with Jeffrey Smith, who is one of the people in the film Scientists Under Attack, Genetic Engineering and the Magnetic Field of Money. And Jeffrey is an activist, author, and consumer advocate who is also the founder of the Institute for Responsible Technology. And Jeffrey's been talking with us about how big a problem this genetically modified food is and what the nature of that problem actually is and why we should all be worried and horrified, not to mention angry. We're now going to be joined by Dr. Ignacio Chapela, microbial ecologist and mycologist at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the scientists who actually dared to stand up and point out some problems or even to point out that something was happening that shouldn't be happening in relation to genetically modified food and genetically modified seeds and its impact on a crop like corn, a fundamental crop for so many people. And for his courage in standing up and pointing that out and even in raising questions, Ignacio Chapela was a target of a massive campaign to discredit him and ruin his career. Ignacio, welcome to the show.
Michael, hello.
Hi. So why don't we jump into this with the first question being, what were you doing that brought down the wrath of the GMO gods?
was just doing my job. I was just doing what a scientist is supposed to do, which is, you know, looking at questions. And my specialty is in microbial ecology, that is the ecology of the little things, you know. And among the little things that aren't so little, they're invisible, but they really are massive transformations of our environment, genetic engineering really ranks very, very high. And so I was interested, I was working with a group of indigenous communities in southern Mexico, and I was interested in, we were interested in finding out whether genetic engineering, engineered corn was going to come to these places. And they were preparing themselves for the detection of genetic engineered corn. And as part of the training that they were going under, the first time we went and ran a workshop, we discovered, to our surprise, that that genetic engineered corn was already there and was already, had already crossed with the native varieties of corn in the cradle of this second most important crop of the world. So that generated a lot of trouble for me. But it was interesting why that trouble came to me. I think the trouble came because we demonstrated that the claim for control, which is really the key claim that this industry has, is simply false, that they really do not have control over what they're doing.
You know, it's interesting because I was going to ask you this. One, how transgenic corn got to central Mexico through what, just wind currents and the wind flow across the continent, whatever? Is that what happened?
Well, there are many reasons. Another thing that has to be said, I think Jeffrey invited us to think about, is the problem that there isn't enough science being put into this. Often people who want to promote genetic engineering say, well, this, leave it to the scientists, we're doing the science. But the reality is that the science is being suppressed, that there isn't enough science and the kind of science that we should be doing. And so we don't know enough. So this is one case. We do not know with exact details how much, when, through which channels all this contamination is moving. And this is what my lab is now dedicated to, developing this capacity. But at that time, we knew that Mexico was receiving about 30 million tons of corn from the U.S., subsidized by U.S. taxpayers, so that it would undercut the nationally produced corn of Mexico because it was coming in at much lower prices, in such a way that farmers were finding it more convenient to take seed from these shipments from the U.S. and plant it than maintaining their own seed. This is an incredibly pernicious thing that was happening and continues to happen, to bring down a, you know, 10,000-year-old culture producing a whole diversity of corn that is the source of diversity for the world, to bring it down to a, you know, a beggar situation where they will receive corn from the U.S. Just because of the really pernicious subsidy pattern that we have for this industry here.
You know, it's interesting, Ignacio, because here I was thinking, okay, well, maybe there was some kind of natural explanation that first that capitalism's, you know, got this stuff out there, and then there was a natural explanation for how it kind of accidentally got there. But then you see the work, when you pointed this out, it's just like a pin in my brain, the workings of imperialism and how the exactly that point about with NAFTA and everything else and the
exactly.
You know, the
There's no way of avoiding that
right.
as the central point.
Right, exactly.
And yes, of course, pollen flies and the, you know, monarch butterflies carry pollen and so on. But really, it is about people. It is about politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, biology is playing into it. But you cannot deny the importance of that.
Well, let me ask you this, Ignacio, because some people might ask, as I was posing before in the beginning of the show, you know, well, what about if you could grow, you know, everybody's familiar with the great famines in the world, you know, particularly in on the continent of Africa. And if you could actually grow wheat that would be hardy enough to withstand a famine, would, you know, you might think, okay, well, maybe we should do that. And would you ever look at something and say, perhaps there's a reason to genetically engineer a hardier type of wheat?
Right. You know, the idea itself of trying anything you can to make human livelihoods better, it's a good idea. And I don't think anybody would stand against it if it was applied in a reasonable way and if it was true. But the reality about this, genetic engineering of crops, look, we are celebrating, if you want, or at least marking the 40th anniversary of transgenesis, which is really the critical biological intervention to produce genetically engineered crops. 40 years for nothing. The reality is that the markets are not happy with these products. The promise of increased yields, the promise of drought resistance, the promise of decreased hunger and so on really have not materialized. They really haven't. There are two products out there in the market that are real, and that is the, you know, the herbicide-resistant crops and the insecticide-producing crops. And otherwise, we really have not, or they really have not, produced all these dreams. So if we want to talk about dreams, I think it would be really nice in a world where we really were able to use technology and use our knowledge to produce whatever is needed to have better livelihoods. But the reality, the real existing after 40 years of development, the real existing genetic engineering is a genetic engineering that is used only for concentration and for exploitation. The limits to growth of plants by water, by simple things like water and light and so on, are limits that are real. You really cannot change that. So the wild dreams of planting wheat in the desert or corn in the desert are really just wild dreams. They're really not true. And the reality is that we do have varieties of all the crops, especially cereals, that have been developed by these people over thousands of years that are the best we have to deal with drought situations in Africa, as much as in Latin America, and other parts of the world. So we are not promoting the science that would help us use those varieties that are already there and promote the livelihoods of those people who have taken care of them. And instead, we are proposing to come up with this harebrained ideas about highly technologized crops that don't even exist, and people really are not coming up with the goods. To replace, to displace, to throw these people out of the land and replace them with highly mechanized, high input, high capital intensive crops. This is exactly what's happening in Africa. There is a massive land grab going on. In South America, farmers are being literally killed out or burnt out of the fields. It is a huge humanitarian catastrophe, all in the name of industrial agriculture and driven through the cutting edge of glyphosate-resistant crops. It is a real disaster where we are basically all complicit. Gates Foundation, for example, is completely identified with Monsanto in Africa, and they're pushing their agenda there. They're pushing their agenda in South America, all with a complicit collaboration of the U.S. government at the highest levels.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking now with Dr. Ignacio Chiappella, microbial ecologist and mycologist at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the scientists who actually dared to stand up and point out some problems, or even to point out that something was happening that shouldn't be happening in relation to genetically modified food and genetically modified seeds and its impact on a crop like corn. Ignacio, we have two more questions for you. When you discovered what you discovered, you went to publish your work in Nature, in the journal Nature.
Yes.
What happened to you after that?
Well, even the publication of the work was extremely difficult. It would take me a while to narrate a really hair-raising story of gangster-like behavior on many sides to try and prevent the publication of this. Eventually, we managed to basically twist the hand of Nature to finally publish it, because Nature was being pressured themselves in the UK by the industry to not publish this paper. So even the publication of it was actually very, very difficult. And of course, I will never be able to publish anything in Nature ever again, I think. But then after that, the level of attacks and discreditation, coordinated discreditation, was something that was really surprising and amazing to see. There was a very well-organized discreditation campaign already in place and running even before the publication of the paper, because the paper had leaked through the reviewing process. We went through five rounds of review because nature got this pressure. And so I don't really know exactly how it started leaking out to the people who would attack us. But by the time the publication was going to be printed, there was already a discreditation campaign against me, against my lab, against my students, and against the publication itself. It was fortunate that a journalist in the UK became interested enough that they did the legwork to find out through through email signatures and server signatures that the campaign was being coordinated by this global PR company in the pay of Monsanto and other of the biotech companies. So it is clear that it was a well-coordinated and well-paid and professionally run discreditation campaign by a global PR company that was paid by Monsanto and company. So it's quite amazing to see the level of monopolizing of power that is put onto this as this one promise that is going to solve the problems of the world. It really was back in the 80s that the U.S. decided this was going to be the replacement of computer technology and material sciences and so on. And they decided, you know, it was the Bush and Quayle administration. They said, we are going to remove all the limitations from this and make them progress. And ever since, we have been completely helpless at being able to see the problems with the technology because you're not allowed to look into it. There are many ways in which people are not only punished but prevented from even looking. If you want to look into a sequence, the DNA sequence in one of these crops, the lawyers from these companies will come and tell you that that is an infringement of their copyright or their patent rights. And so it has become a time of obscurantism, a time of no science, and many scientists know better than even touching this with a 10-foot pole. And so it has become really a main driver of the economy or the hoped-for economy, and at the same time, an orphan science with no scientist who, in their right mind, will go into it. And those who go get into trouble.
And even more, at the same time, just a bane on the entire planet and the global ecosystem and everything else. And I'll ask you this. We have about a minute and a half for you to answer this. But in your mind, if you could capsulize, what do you think is the biggest danger? What worries you the most about this progression of genetically modified crops, animals, food? What worries you the most?
As a microbial ecologist, the movement of these transformed materials into non-crop organisms worries me the most. Mm-hmm. This is promiscuous DNA that will find its way to other species through horizontal gene transfer. And the way that is transforming already our environments is something that really does worry me. Mm-hmm. Worries me that nobody can see, that there is no way that people can find out. And that's why I'm going to put in a plug for the resolution that's being promoted here in California to label GMOs. We cannot know because there is no labels on these products. We cannot really know the extent to which human health has been damaged, the way Jeffrey was talking about, because we don't have a way of controlling and seeing who is eating what. So labeling, to me, is something that worries me and makes me hopeful at the same time that with a very simple stroke, we could really change the game in such a way that we as a public could have a little bit of control over these technologies.
All right, Ignacio, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now.
Thank you for your program. Bye-bye.
Sure. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Jeffrey Smith and Professor Ignacio Chiappella from Berkeley, talking to them about the genetic modification of food crops, of animals, of all this stuff, and what the impact is on humanity and on the overall global ecological system. And now I want you to think about something else. Think about why this system that they tout as the highest form of human existence, why this system cannot give you the right to eat. A most basic right, and we don't have it. And we won't have it while we live under this system of capitalism. And I want you to check this this little piece out from Bob Avakian and think about all that as you're listening.
Well, let's come at the nature of the capitalist system from another angle, one which I've spoken to previously. The right to eat. Here there's mass starvation and mass malnutrition among billions of people, a very large section of the population of human beings on the earth today who are not getting enough to eat, just to take something very basic. Now, if you step back from the particulars of the way the world is, you hear people say, well, that's the way the world is. That's just the way life is. Life is not fair. Life ain't shit by itself. Life does not exist in a vacuum or an abstract. Life exists through the working out of contradictions rooted in the basic contradictions of a system that prevails at a given time. That's what goes on, not life in some abstract sense that somehow exists up in the sky unrelated to what's going on, or, you know, some force that works its way through human beings in some mystical sense. The reason, quote-unquote, life is not fair is because the capitalist system operates according to certain dynamics. And one of them is that most of the people in the world scramble to have barely enough to eat or don't succeed in having enough to eat. That is a daily existence for the majority of humanity. Now, if you step back from it, you would say to yourself, well, what could be more basic than the right to eat? What is more essential to life than the basic right to eat and to have some shelter and to have clothes? But in a concentrated sense, the right to eat, what could be more basic? How can it be that you have a world in which there is no right to eat, in which the great majority of humanity either does not have enough to eat or has to scuffle every day to try to get enough to eat? How can that be, especially amidst all the wealth there is in the world that surrounds and mocks people at every turn? Once again, materialism, dialectical materialism, teaches us that this is because of the fundamental production relations of capitalism, the fundamental contradiction of capitalism between the socially produced wealth and the private capitalist accumulation of that wealth by aggregations of competing capitalists. By the very phenomenon that's described by the preliminary transformation into capital, by the phenomenon of the need for capital to reproduce itself, not to reproduce social wealth to be distributed according to the needs of the people, but to reproduce itself as capital on an expanded scale. There's a vast difference between reproducing wealth on an expanded scale, which can be and is applied to meet social needs, and reproducing wealth on an expanded basis as capital. And in understanding that difference, you understand fundamental things about why the world is the way it is and how it could be radically different. The fact that there is no right to eat, something which was pointed out in the book Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That, in other places, has to do, once again, with Marx's statement that right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and the culture conditioned thereby. In other words, because of the basic character of capitalist production relations and the fundamental contradiction of capitalism to which I've just spoken, there can be and there is no right to eat. You eat or don't eat according to the dictates of the dynamics of capitalist accumulation. If you can contribute to the reproduction of capital on an expanded scale, in profitable enough terms for this or that capitalist or aggregation of capital, you can eat to one degree or another. If you do not or cannot in a given time or circumstances, you cannot eat unless you go find some other way to get something to eat, which is what some people, for example, who've been basically locked out of the economic system, repeatedly strive to do. But they have no right to eat. If you step back and you say, what could be more basic to human association than the right of its the members who make up that association, or the people, the human beings who make up that human association, to eat? But it doesn't matter that that's a fundamental human need. It doesn't translate, that fundamental human need does not translate into a fundamental human right within the confines of the fundamental contradiction and the production relations and corresponding social relations and superstructure, including the laws of capitalist society. There's a fundamental need. There's no fundamental right. Why? Once again, because of the production relations, the social relations, and the corresponding superstructure, including politics and law, and the enforcement of law within the confines of a capitalist system. Or let's look at the parasitism of imperialism, which I've spoken to several points in the course of this talk. I referred to Marx's statement about the rosy dawn of capitalism, the entombment in the minds of millions of native peoples in Bolivia and other parts of Latin, what we call Latin America today. Slavery, exploitation of child labor. This was the rosy dawn of the initial capitalist accumulation, sometimes called primitive accumulation of the capitalist system as a whole. But what is it today? What is the character and driving force of capitalist accumulation today in capitalism's stage of imperialism, its worldwide system of exploitation? It is exactly the reproduction on an even broader and more intense level in many ways of what Marx was describing sardonically and ironically in talking about the rosy dawn of capitalism. It is child labor, not just in one or a few countries in Europe, but on a massive scale, in the hundreds of millions. It is conditions of labor for masses of people, hundreds of millions, which are barely better than conditions of slavery. And not only conditions of labor, but conditions of life more broadly. It is the turning of human beings on a massive scale into the means to make wealth for others, even in the most degrading terms, such as the large-scale sex trade that goes on internationally today under imperialism. Throughout the world, this rosy dawn is being repeated in the twilight years of capitalism and what we must make the twilight and final years of capitalism in a broad historical sense. This is still the foundation of capitalism and imperialism. We must never allow people to be fooled by the fact that people go to business school, wear suits that cost in the thousands of dollars, and can speak an articulate language. They are still, not everyone who does that, but those who are representatives of this system are still standing on that pulpit of bones. They are still standing on the children who labor in horrific conditions every day of the week, 12 hours a day. They are still standing on the bodies of people torn to shred in the wars to enforce this exploitation. They are still standing on the bodies, broken and degraded, of the women who were traded like commodities and even worse in this system. They are still standing on the bodies of people all over the world who were driven from one set of horrendous conditions to even worse ones, uprooted and flung across the globe in the desperate search for some kind of life. They are still standing on that foundation. That is still the rosy nature of their system, no matter how they dress it up and no matter what intellectual accoutrements it may take on, what intellectual dress it may take on. And please understand, this is not an attack on intellectuals. I'm talking about the intellectual rationalizations and the people who speak as representatives and apologists and defenders of the capitalist system, whom you see go out and speak in refined terms. But that is refinement dripping with blood. It is what Malcolm X said, a bloody-jawed wolf with blood running down its jaw. It's like the movie Them or whatever it was, where you had to have special glasses to see the hyena-like nature of the people who were among us. This is the nature of this ruling class. This is not exaggeration or communist rhetoric and hyperbole. This is a reality which I am struggling to describe to find the terms to describe in its full horrific dimensions. And we should understand this fully.
That was Bob Avakian on The Right to Eat. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor about her recent participation in a project to take patriarchy by storm in New York City. And Sansara just got out of jail, so she'll be joining us to talk about that whole experience. So stay tuned. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, Sansara Taylor. Sansara has been on the show many times before. She's always welcome and always brings a hell of a lot of spark to the show and to your heads. And just recently, Sansara, one of the initiators, she's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's also one of the initiators of the movement to end porn and patriarchy, the enslavement and degradation of women. And Sansara was recently arrested, leaving St. Patrick's Cathedral, a historically right-wing, anti-birth control, anti-abortion, anti-queer, and anti-woman stronghold. And Sansara spent a night in jail, and she's here to talk to us about what the hell was going on. Sansara, welcome to the show, and what the hell was going on?
Hi, Michael. I'm so glad to be with you. Yeah, I recently did get released from jail. I spent a night in the filthy, small, lonely cell in Midtown North Manhattan, along with Alice Woodward, another writer for Revolution Newspaper and participant in the project to end porn and patriarchy. And this was following a weekend of really uplifting, righteous protests at sites that really concentrate the enslavement and degradation of women. And specifically, we were arrested immediately following a protest inside St. Patrick's Cathedral, which, as you said, it's a historically and notoriously anti-woman stronghold. It is the home of Timothy Dolan, and he's the cardinal who's the head of the U.S. Catholic bishops, who spearheaded the recent political and legal revolt against the new requirements that birth control be covered as part of health care. He is somebody who has been vehemently against the right to abortion. The Catholic Church, of course, preaches that divorce is a sin, that birth control is a sin. And so because the Catholic Church has made itself a concentrated center of the war on women, it is legitimate grounds for protest and raising voices against this war. There was, inside the cathedral, the words rang out in the incredible acoustics of this daunting, enormous cathedral. Abortion on demand and without apology. Forced motherhood is female enslavement. And then the chant went up, stop the war on women. And so this was really a beautiful moment. It was a righteous and uplifting moment. And it came on the heels of, or as a culmination, sort of a highlight of a whole 10 days throughout New York City of taking patriarchy by storm. And so I did, myself and Alice Woodward were arrested and charged with criminal trespass and a violation-level trespass, which are completely illegitimate charges. We were leaving the church, and we are going to fight those charges, but we're very proud of the fact that there was a protest held inside the cathedral.
Sounds great to me, I'll tell you. As a formerly tortured Catholic, I was, left it when I was 8 years old, but the scars never heal, okay?
The Catholic Church is very notorious.
Yes. Well, let's talk about this. You kept talking, you mentioned a couple times this project to basically to take patriarchy by storm. Then why don't you tell people what this is? Because this is a pretty exciting project that was announced a few weeks ago, actually ran from August 4th to the 14th. And the project to take patriarchy by storm, what is this about?
Well, there is a war going on against women. It's a very real war. It's claiming the lives of real women in this country and across the world. And it's causing incredible suffering and trauma and stigma and shame and violence and degradation against women. And what we decided is that about a year ago, we initiated a movement to end pornography and patriarchy, because the way we see this war, the way we understand this, is that it's all-encompassing, but it sort of has two major fronts, and they appear to people as different, but they're really sort of twisted mirror opposites. On the one hand, you have the reassertion of traditional patriarchal chains through the church, through the reassertion of forced motherhood, the attacks on birth control, the attacks on abortion, the stigma against women who have sex or have abortions, who use birth control, the legal restrictions against abortion and against sex education, all of this on the one side. And then on the other side, you have the increasingly violent, the increasingly degrading, brutal, demeaning nature of pornography, even as pornography becomes more and more mainstream. And this both reflects and reinforces a whole global economy of selling women's bodies. It prepares men to be callously purchasing women's bodies in the international sex slave trade, the young girls who are pimped in this country. All of this is of a piece. And so our view is that there's really no difference. Both reduce women to objects, one to breeders of children, the other to sexualized objects to be used and degraded. And women are neither. Women are full human beings. So we launched this movement to fight against all of this about a year ago. And we've done some important things, but we really came to the understanding that we had to take this to a different level. And so we called on activists and supporters from around the country to come to New York City for 10 days. And we called it Take Patriarchy by Storm. And our view was that we really have to start fighting this. We call it a war because it's a real war, and we have to start acting in ways that are commensurate. So we took this project out. We did what we called social interventions. We went to major festivals and block parties out in Brooklyn and other places with our stickers that say, if you can't imagine sex without porn, you're effed. Our stickers that said, create a world without rape, fluorescent, really bright colored stickers that say, abortion on demand and without apology. And we got them out in the crowd in huge numbers together with a card that said seven things you can do to end the enslavement and degradation of women. We took this out to public parks and we built a wall.
Sansara, first let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and a person who's been involved in the last 10 days. She's been involved in a project called Take Patriarchy by Storm, which went out and fought against patriarchy and porn all through New York City. And Sansara was arrested just a little while ago. And she just got out of jail last night, and she was arrested outside of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And we're talking about that whole project and what the hell's going on around it. Now, Sansara, this wall is very interesting to me. That's something I really wanted to ask you about. So tell me a little bit about that.
We had people who we met on the spot come and tell their stories from the war zone. Women told their stories of being molested as children, of being in abusive marriages for 28 years, their stories of being abused in the sex industry, prostituted, and their lives in danger in that institution. Men told stories of women's degradation, of women that they knew. And so we built this wall that collected these stories. And every day we took the same wall and displayed back to a Union Square, a major place in New York City. And it got bigger and bigger, and more people joined us. And so it was an experience of really dragging these stories out of the dark and making them a part of waking other people up and giving people a vehicle to take those injuries, that pain that women have been forced to deal with, and the shame, and putting it out in the open in the light of day and making it part of the fuel to end all of this. And so we've been doing, you know, we've done film showings, we've done discussions, we've been all over the city, but then we really felt that, again, we have to start putting something on the line in line with the fact that there is a real war on women. And so the last weekend, I'm so proud, I'm so uplifted, and I'm so thrilled with what we did, because we called the protest, we began at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and again, it's got all this sanctimony and this authority of religious, you know, the authority of God that's supposedly invested in it, and thousands of years of traditions, chains, and all the awe that people are taught to have for this really illegitimate and woman-hating institution. So we began at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and this was the day before my arrest, and we had just dozens of us went up right onto the steps, right in front of the front door of the cathedral, and we took this, we had printed up crime scene tape, yellow bright tape that says, danger, crimes against women, and we draped it in front of the door. And we stood up on the steps of the cathedral, and we delivered in mic check cadence, call and response and echoing collective voices thunderously in this cathedral entrance, a call to action against the enslavement and degradation of women. And so we read our entire call to action. And then we took off. I mean, we didn't just take off. We stayed, we rallied for a little while, but then we took off, and we went into the original Hooters restaurant. And this was phenomenal.
We're talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and one of the participants in the 10-day-long campaign to take patriarchy by storm all across New York City. So, Sansara, You went into the original Hooters. What the hell did you do in there?
We went into the original Hooters restaurant and just took over. We disrupted people's lunches. We disrupted their Hooters, where they can order drinks in glasses of decapitated women's bodies with large breasts to be fondled as you're drinking and laughing and ogling the waitresses who are there in low-cut shirts and very short shorts to be looked at by the men who are dining there, where this is just part of male bonding and male culture. We went in and we said, no, not today. Men are not allowed to have this space, because if men have this space to bond over the degradation and objectification of women's bodies, women are not going to have the space to be free of that anywhere in society. And so we went into that space and we chanted and we spoke out, and men threw things at us and threw insults at us, and we just had a fantastic time.
I wanted to be there. Come on.
We didn't even stop there. I'm telling you, Michael, nothing like this. I've been part of fighting against the assaults on women, on women's lives, the assaults on women's reproductive life, rights, violence against women, rape culture, and the massive rates. 1 in 5 women will be raped or sexually assaulted in her life. I've been a part of fighting this. This was, as one woman who was part of this project says, I've hated this my whole life. I've never seen it opposed like this before. And so we were in the Hooters. We marched down to the porn stores in Times Square. We went into the porn stores in Times Square. And again, people took the porn off the shelves and were looking at this, where you can buy torture porn. You can buy porn that celebrates sexual molestations, plot lines of little girls being molested by their stepfathers or their uncles. And that's just one of the thematics that you can find. All of this objectification, degradation, humiliation, just sheer violence and racist caricatures. And we just spoke out about it. And the porn stores flipped out. So after we left the first porn store, the guy is actually telling us, go down the street, there's another porn store. And so we go down, he's trying to get rid of us, but he'd also called ahead. So we get to the next porn store, and they've locked their doors before we get there. And so we're rallying, and it was a day all the time. Women seek to avoid coming right up against the most vitriolic hatred of women. You try to avoid it. You try not to walk alone at night. You try to do things that will protect you from the hatred and degradation that surrounds women all the time. And no matter how careful you are, you're never safe from it. Women, no matter what you do, you could be a victim of rape. You could be a victim of sexual assault. You could be a victim of not having access to doctors who can give you abortion or birth control when you need it. This is the world we live in. And so for one day, instead of seeking to avoid this and failing because you can't avoid it, we went right into the heart of the biggest concentrations of the hatred and degradation of women. And I'm telling you, by going up against it and fighting it, it was the most liberated space, the most uplifting space, a taste of the future that's possible, and that we are determined in this movement. Because the whole point of this Take Patriarchy by Storm was to bring people together and to launch a movement that is the beginning of the end of patriarchy. Not just registering our opposition, not just making it known that this is really bad, but really saying we're not putting up with this anymore. And when we get out there and we do this, it has connected with people, because so many people and women are choking on their rage at what they've experienced in their lives, whether it be molested as children. We had people, I have to tell you, I know I'm not stopping talking, but this was one of the most visceral and uplifting experiences that I've ever had. When we left the first porn store, and I spoke in front of it after they pushed us out and threatened us and all of this, and so I'm on the steps and I'm saying, look, we're not afraid of this. We're here today because women are raped and abused every day. They're molested in their homes every day. They're sold on the streets and traded as chattel sex slaves every day. And, you know, pornography reflects this, it concentrates it, it celebrates it, and we are not standing for this. And as we left that store, we went down the block, and I look over, and slumped on the ground, literally sitting on the curb, are two of the young women who came here from different parts of the country, and they are sobbing. Their faces are streaming in tears, and they're just shaking. You could see they're physically, violently shaking. And I go over, and one of them says, you know, you said this thing when we were in front of the porn store about little girls being molested in their own homes. She said, that happened to me when I was 5 years old. And she's just shaking. It just all came out. She said, it's like it tore open. And so I put my arm around her, and so did the other woman. And I said, you know what? Today you can speak about this. And she stood up, and she gave the most powerful, the most heartfelt, the most poetic but deep and strong indictment of what had been done to her as a child, and how her whole life she's been made to choke on the shame that she feels for something that she should not be ashamed for. And she described the feeling of going into that Hooters restaurant and being looked at by those men who were so upset that we disrupted their lunch. And she says, you don't have the right to eat your lunch in peace when it's about degrading women while we're spending our whole lives choking on our shame. And we're done with that. And today we stood up and fought, and I'm going to keep doing this. And I'm telling you, by the time we were on a side street, we stopped there because she was on the ground. We didn't stop there because it was a protest site that we had planned. But by the time she was done speaking, and this was a side street, this was off Main Avenue, we had drawn a crowd, not just our own protesters, but a crowd of people who were passing by, tourists from around the world and New Yorkers who stopped. And you know, when you look at their faces, you know, and you know the statistics, 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 women has had this experience. You know that many of those gathered who are listening were saying, that's my story. I've never heard this said before in public. And this is the feeling that we had, and this is what we've begun. And the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian have popularized this slogan, break the chains, unleash the fury of women as a mighty force for revolution. And one of the things that acknowledges is that maybe it's suppressed, maybe it's in a little box, maybe you're fighting every day to keep it stacked up neat in a little orderly way so you can cope with your life, but women are furious. Some of them it's closer to the surface and some of them it's more suppressed, but there is a fury that actually needs to be tapped into and unleashed. And this movement, something has begun here. Something began on the steps of St. Patrick's, inside the porn stores, inside the Hooters, when that young woman stood up from being slumped. And she said afterwards, she said her throat felt clear for the first time.
Wow.
She said she felt lighter than she's felt, that she can remember. She calmed down. She wasn't shaking. She felt strong, and others felt strong because of it. And this is something that we began, and it's very, very important. And I'm telling you, if you, not just if you hate what women go through, if you're a decent thinking person, you better hate what women are forced to go through. And if you don't think it's that bad, then start asking around and looking around, because women right now are being slammed backwards in every dimension, and we have to fight, and women and men need to join together and fight. And that was what was so thrilling about what we've done the last 10 days. And we've got, I mean, I haven't even scratched the surface of all the things that we did, but we've got so much more that we're planning. And the whole point is that people went back to where they came from around the country, and we're taking this national.
And we will have you back on the show to talk about this as you sort it all out and begin to popularize a lot of what happened. And Sansara, just one thing, if people around the country want to get in touch with you, want to find out how to become part of this movement, what do they do?
Please do write to us. Please get in touch. I want you to visit our website at stoppatriarchy.org, but please take the time and write us a letter. The letters mean a great deal, and some of them, with your permission, we take off the names, we publish them. Tell your story that needs to be taken out of the dark and put in the light, and get involved, because there are days of actions that we're planning coming up. Find our email list. You can do that at our website. And yeah, we're just getting started.
All right, Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, that brings our show to a close. And again, this is the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com.